You have asylum seekers, people who are fleeing violence, gang violence, in Sarah's case, also domestic violence, who are coming up here. And as they cross the border and say that they have a fear of going back to their home country, they're immediately detained pending a determination on their case.
We have 45 seconds. So explain what you're calling for right now.
So what we've been calling for all along is that I should be using their discretion with regards to their parole process to release her so that she can get adequate medical care and be able to live with her family who are already here.
In New York.
In New York until the challenge on her claim is completed.
And Fatima Maarouf, what do you expect to come out of this? This is a bond hearing today?
This is a bond hearing before the Dallas Immigration Court, and we're all hoping that the judge will issue a bond.
And do you know how much she will have to pay, whether she can do this?
We don't know until the judge issues the order. Her family's obviously been working hard to gather money in order to post a bond, and when we know the amount, then they will immediately post it if they have it.
Well, we will certainly continue to cover this. People should go to our website at democracynow.org, and we'll put out word today what happens in that hearing. Fatima Maarouf, attorney for Sarah Beltran-Hernandez, bioethics expert Bryn Esplin, and Justin Mazzola of Amnesty International, thank you so much. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. The evening news is next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 27th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, taking place Thursdays through Sundays until March 4th at PCC Cascade in Portland. The Cascade Festival of African Films shows us Africa through the eyes of Africans, rather than a Vision of Africa package for Western viewers. The films celebrate Africa's achievements, expose its failures, and reveal possibilities for a hopeful future. The festival includes live music performances, plays and short films, documentary, and a Women's Filmmakers Week. Again, that's the 27th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, Thursday through Sundays until March 4th, at Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Room 104 at Portland Community College, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. More information and specific times for the screenings can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, From Our Hands to Yours, celebrating 44 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll look at the implications of President Trump's call for higher military spending.
Portland's Mayor Ted Wheeler has proposed new rules to bar disruptive protesters from city council meetings.
And we'll take a look at the ongoing legal battle to overturn Texas's voter ID law, which has hit a snag in the shape of new Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 2nd, 2017. I'm Zelos Moshant.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler said that he will impose new rules allowing him to eject disruptive people from Portland City Council meetings after jeering protesters again prevented the council from doing its city business on Wednesday. Protesters have repeatedly shut down city council meetings ever since Wheeler's first day in office. Wheeler paused yesterday's council meeting twice in the hopes that protesters would settle down, and he eventually moved the meeting to behind locked doors at City Hall. Wheeler plans to introduce a policy next week that would allow the council's presiding officer to eject people for disruptive, dangerous, or threatening behavior for up to 24 hours. In some cases, disruptive individuals could be excluded for up to a year. A mayoral spokesman said the new policy is likely to meet constitutional challenges because it is more specific and focused than other proposed changes that courts have rejected in the past.
Meeting in New Orleans this week, the American Association of School Administrators named Matt Utterback as National Superintendent of the Year. The award follows the superintendent's designation as the 2017 Oregon Superintendent of the Year. The national award goes to the school district chief judged to have shown the greatest leadership to remote student learning. During Utterback's 5 years at the helm of the North Clackamas School District, the graduation rate and test scores went from mediocre to near tops among large Oregon districts, in spite of severe budgetary constraints. The improvements came even as the school board closed schools, cut days off the school year, and raised high school class sizes in order to balance budgets. The district is known for its strong career technical course offerings held at a professional technical center. In the past year, that center received $750,000 to expand and enhance its 16 career tech programs.
Early in this year's legislative session, Medford's Republican representative, Sal Esquivel, sponsored three bills aimed at immigrants in the state. Today, he announced in a press release that all three were, quote, dead on arrival at the desk of House Speaker Tina Kotek and would not receive a public hearing. Esquivel is one of the more conservative members of the Oregon House. He's a member of the American Legislative Exchange Council, known as ALEC, and he's previously attended meetings of so-called constitutional sheriff organizations, which don't recognize jurisdictions above the level of county sheriff. His bills, intended to make sanctuary cities illegal, also to establish English as the one official language of Oregon, and to require anyone doing business with the state to use the controversial E-Verify system to determine if their employees are citizens. Esquivel complained in his press release about how much more partisan the state legislature has become in the previous 2 years, referring to the atmosphere as, quote, oppressive. Esquivel is calling on supporters of those bills to turn them into ballot measures in the near future. He pointed to the success of Measure 88 back in 2014 as proof that voters could pass these initiatives themselves. Measure 88, as you remember, overrode a new law that had allowed undocumented immigrants to get driver cars here in Oregon.
Gentrification is often seen as a static phenomenon that primarily affects poor neighborhoods whose sole challenge is to find another home. But as the Oregon rental crisis has become a national crisis, communities coast to coast, including the Portland metro area and its suburbs, are finding themselves forced to coexist with the displacement of established districts. Tensions are running high and feelings are complicated as new neighbors grapple with new ideas of what community is. Last Tuesday, around 2:05 p.m. at 129th and East Burnside, Amber Arpin and her partner were preparing to go on a walk. As they crossed their lawn, they heard 8 shots and hid in the near bushes till it was quiet. As they came out, they spotted a young man on the ground bleeding and contacted the Portland police. KBOO News Director Zelos Marchant spoke with Arpin over the phone today.
Hey, Amber.
Hi.
It's Zelos. Thanks so much.
Of course.
Very, very cool. Are you okay? How are you doing?
Oh, we're fine. You know, just a kind of a little bit of a reality check, you know?
Sure.
Feeling a little unnerved, you know, supposed to be summer and kind of getting the reality of, like, there's going to be a lot of stuff happening outside again. So, but I've lived there for 7 years, so unfortunately this has been kind of like a, you know, this is the second actual shooting of, like, a young man that has occurred within less than a block of my house, for example. Yeah, there's actually quite a bit of gang activity in our neighborhood, and I don't want to be, like, you know, alarmist or anything like that. It's just sort of the reality.
Sure.
And I ended up moving there, and, you know, we're going about our business. But it's kind of funny because we're, like, the weirdos with goats and big gardens and, like, dogs running around the yard, and it's just a harsh reality. You know, something like this happens. You know, we have our own little kind of, like, utopia, and there's still, like, real things happening right outside of our yard, you know?
Absolutely. Have you noticed an increase since January, or has it just been something that's been steadily increasing in your neighborhood over the course of, like, a couple years or something?
I think there's just, like, a feeling of resentment that I've noticed over the last couple of years of, you know, all these big apartment buildings are getting put in where houses were, and there's a lot more renters, and people are getting pushed out from, like, in our northeast and North Portland to our neighborhood, which used to just kind of be, like, a working-class neighborhood with a lot of old folks, and now it's kind of changing, and, like, you can kind of tell that people didn't live there because they wanted to live there, and there's not a lot of, like, neighborliness or, like, feeling of, you know, friendliness that, you know, in my experience, I'm just kind of, like, getting used to living somewhere that I chose to live, and other people are, like, sorry.
No, don't be sorry. But, nothing to be sorry about.
But, you know, it's just, there's a lot of tension, and I feel it. But, you know.
I'm sure this, you know, like, this one factor of displacement that I think people are just starting to experience and talk about is it's not just about, like, rents changing and gentrification and then people just finding a new house, but communities are being together, you know, and without really wanting to have that happen.
Exactly. Or, like, the time and the intention, you know, and also just, I understand that resentment, like, if you had a home and you lived around people that you were comfortable with and then now you're living in some crappy apartment and, you know, you have to take the bus, like, 100 blocks in and, you know, I get it. I try not to, you know, like, poke the bear, so they say. Like, mm-hmm. if people are visibly unfriendly or upset, I'm just like, I get it, man. Like, you know, move off out of there, kind of. But it's hard when that's where I've kind of, like, laid my claim and we're doing all these, like, you know, projects to try to make the neighborhood nicer, more community-driven, but it's not, like, it's a friendly these days.
Have the Portland Police been in touch with you, and how involved
are you
in games? You're laughing really, like, foretelling. You're like, I just said it all right there, I feel. Like,
usually, like, God, it's like, do I even want to call? You know, this time we called for sure, because it was like, that was like 8 gunshots. And it was right there, and we literally, like, laid it down on our bellies on the ground in our yard and called 911. But, I mean, a lot of times you just kind of get triggered, like, well, what do you want me to do about it, or, like, did anything come? But, you know, there's been, this response time was crazy fast, and they definitely, like, shut down the street and seemed to be thorough, but I don't feel like we have a neighborhood relationship with the police. You know,
certainly.
We've had a lot of action, and there were plenty of opportunities where I was kind of like, come on, man, like, let's be thinking about this, or let's talk about it, and, you know, here's all the information I've got, and then it just sort of dead-ended, so. Mm-hmm. We definitely feel like if the things that were happening in our neighborhood were happening in, like, Irvington, or, you know, like, somewhere with really fancy houses, it would be treated like, you know, the biggest thing that ever happened. But for us, it's just kind of, you know, the numbers for, like, the wild, wild east.
Yeah, it's almost eloquent, and yet not. Completely.
I don't need to be, like, flippant about any of it. You know, it's like people's real lives, and it's super serious, and we're just trying to, you know, we've been talking a lot about what we can do to be good neighbors, and, you know, it's a complicated issue.
For sure. Well, I don't think there's any harm in being flippant, because how else is one supposed to deal with an incredible amount of tension? We need humor to deal with the original realities, for sure. Well, I will let you go. I know you've got to get to work. Again, we appreciate you taking the time to give us a phone call. Have a great day. And rest up when you can.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You bet. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was me, Zealous Marchant, speaking with Amber Arpin, who witnessed a shooting at 129th and East Burnside on Tuesday.
The president's call for a $54 billion increase in military spending means that other programs and services would have to be slashed. Advocates for programs that might be on the chopping block are urging Oregonians to speak up now, warning that the cuts would be felt at both the state and local levels. Some people also don't want foreign aid to be reduced. KABU reporter Demi Hellenius has more from the Oregon News Service.
President Donald Trump calls to increase military spending by $54 billion. Likely means cuts will be made to some politically sensitive programs, from education and the environment to science and fighting poverty. Trump first announced his plans Monday to the National Governors Association and shared more details in a speech to Congress last night. Lindsay Koshgarian of the National Priorities Project says it's unclear where the hike in defense funding would come from. She says this is the time for citizens to speak up, noting that cuts would have a trickle-down effect on states, cities, and counties.
There are a lot of reasons for members of Congress to care about this. The good news is that Congress actually has quite a large say in what the final budget looks like. So the right thing to do is to contact your member of Congress and let them know what your concerns are.
President Trump has said the money will come from, in his words, a revved-up economy. He has also said it's time for America to start winning wars again. But the budget proposal has a long way to go, and some pushback from Congress is almost certain. The U.S. spends 21 times more on the military than it does on foreign aid programs. Although in Koshgarian's views, foreign aid for causes like fighting hunger and disease does more to increase stability around the world.
We actually get a lot in return for that money in the form of added security for our country. And if we don't spend that money, we will need to spend more on the other side fighting wars. And I don't think that's a choice that anyone would want to make.
Koshgarian thinks any new military funding should come first from ending wasteful spending within the Pentagon itself. She adds programs that make people's lives better shouldn't be raided, when some believe the Pentagon itself is doing its fair share to combat waste. For KABU News, I'm Demi Hellenius.
President Trump heloed onto the deck of the USS Gerald R. Ford, an aircraft carrier under construction at the Huntington Ingalls Shipyard in Newport News, in a show of military power designed to gain support for his recent defense budget proposal. The Gerald R. Ford promises to be one of the Navy's most sophisticated warships. Trump called the carrier, quote, a monument of American might, end quote. But the project has gone billions of dollars over budget and taken several years longer to build than anticipated. At a 2015 hearing, Senator McCain called it, quote, one of the most spectacular acquisition debacles in recent memory, end quote, asserting that we could not afford to spend $13 billion on one ship. Trump made no mention of the overruns, but he touted the White House budget, which would add $54 billion to the Pentagon spending, a roughly 10% increase. This increase is in the face of major cuts to other agencies, notably the EPA.
A new era is dawning at the Port of Portland, though for whose benefit remains to be seen. The port's Terminal 6, the only major container shipping terminal in the state, has been run by the Philippines-based company ICTSI since 2010. Before that, the port operated the terminal for 30 years and lost money on it every year except for two. They subsidized the terminal anyway as part of their mandate to facilitate shipping in Oregon. The ICTSI ran into trouble with the Longshoremen's Union, ILWU Local 8, almost immediately, culminating in last year's de facto shutdown of the terminal as major shipping lines took their business to other West Coast ports with less labor strife. Earlier this week, the port and ICTSI agreed to mutually terminate the lease, meaning that the port will take back control of the troubled terminal, which essentially gives itself the job of reanimating the corpse of container shipping in Oregon. The ICTSI agreed to pay the port more than $11 million and to return $10 million worth of equipment. The port still faces a challenge in the state legislature this year from Senate Bill 530, which would force the port to give control of the Terminal 6 to a new Oregon shipping authority. Neither the port, nor the ICTSI, nor the ILWU responded to requests or comments before airtime today.
Yeah, many Americans with businesses in Oakland, California, say they worry about the impact on their livelihoods of increased deportations of undocumented immigrants under President Trump, many of whom are their customers. Reporter Farida Javala Romero with KQED San Francisco's California Report has more.
Mujib Alamari works the register and bags groceries at his store in Oakland's heavily Latino Fruitvale neighborhood.
Muchas gracias.
Like other Yemeni American shop owners in the area, he disagrees with President Trump's recent orders on immigration. And he tells me this in Spanish, a language he speaks more than English. There's two problems, he says. A new travel ban would make it harder for his wife and children who live in Yemen to move here. And stepped up deportations of undocumented immigrants could hurt long-term customers he cares about. Even though Alamari is a U.S. citizen, he fears traveling to Yemen now could cause him problems. Down the street, another store owner, Abdul Talib, who also has a U.S. passport, is canceling his vacation plans to Mexico. Why? He says flying with a Middle Eastern name was already a headache under the Obama administration.
So now I imagine with this administration, it's going to be even harder.
Talib was relieved when the courts intervened with President Trump's original travel ban, targeting citizens from Yemen and other Muslim-majority countries. But others say the courts should stay out of it. Dan Stein is from the Federation for American Immigration Reform, a nonprofit that seeks to reduce immigration.
The president has the responsibility of ensuring that people coming into this country as visitors, as refugees, as immigrants, that they are not people being sent as operatives who would engage in terrorism.
Regardless of how the new travel ban affects people from Muslim countries, Talib says he worries more about the Latino community around him. At his store, he's organizing an event to inform undocumented immigrants about their rights. For the California Report, I'm Farida Javala Romero.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. After the news, we'll hear an in-depth piece about the restoration of the B-17 Madras Maiden in Hillsboro and the veterans who love her. Stay tuned at 6 o'clock for Rose City Native Radio, and at 7 it'll be Ear to the Streets of Portland, featuring conversations around organizing in the Black and African community here in Portland and beyond. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy, as usual, with a high chance of light showers throughout the day, a high of about 51, a low of about 37, just average. Today, back in history, in 1901, the United States Steel Corporation was formed by a merger of Carnegie Steel and Federal Steel. It became the first business in the world worth over $1 billion. And 36 years later, in 1937, the Steel Workers Organizing Committee signed a collective bargaining agreement with the United States Steel, effectively unionizing the American steel industry. Further on in time, in 2004, saw the Ashura bombings in Karbala, Iraq, in which members of Al-Qaeda in Iraq killed 170 people and injured at least 500 more. It was one of the deadliest days of the United States occupation of Iraq. The quote for today is from Chicano writer Rudolfo Anaya, who said, "When people ask me where my roots are, I look down at my feet and I see the roots of my soul grasping the earth."
While email file sizes have increased by leaps and bounds in recent years, most email providers still place a strangely low limit on the size of files that can be sent and received as attachments. In a brief blog post, Google announced that Gmail will now allow you to receive attachments up to 50 megabytes in size. However, don't get too excited about this. Google noted that size limits will remain the same at 25 megabytes for outgoing messages, and the larger attachments will still need to be sent on Google Drive.
Comparing America's two political parties and their attitude toward the environment, it is reported that United States House Republicans cast pro-environmental votes only 5% of the time in 2016. Their Democratic colleagues tallied a 94% voting record. This is all according to the League of Conservation Voters. Meanwhile, in the Senate, the average GOP Republican member was voting pro-environment only 14% of the time. The Democrats' average was 96%. That makes the 114th Congress the most politically polarized in the 46-year history of the League's scorecard. Rebecca Williams of Michigan Radio has more on this.
Scoring our lawmakers on their votes. This is the Environment Report. I'm Rebecca Williams. The League of Conservation Voters has released its annual scorecard. It shows how members of Congress voted on environmental issues. This year, the group found a deep partisan divide.
I think it is no surprise to anyone that the same partisan politics and the same partisan breakdown of environmental issues you see on the federal level, you see in Michigan as well.
That's Charlotte Jameson. She's the government affairs director for the Michigan League of Conservation Voters. The group just published its own scorecard for the state legislature.
What I find most interesting from last session is that there were really, really great examples where we were able to get things done in a bipartisan way, and we were able to get substantial Republican support for things like the energy bill package.
She says Michigan lawmakers are often able to find common ground on Great Lakes issues and when economics come into play. This is the Environment Report. Scientists have known that spring is arriving earlier across the U.S. because of climate change. Now you can take a look at new maps to see exactly how early spring tends to arrive where you live. Jake Weltzien is an ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, and he joins me now. Hi, Jake.
Hello there.
How much earlier is spring arriving on average in the U.S.?
Well, it depends a little bit on where you are. So if you're in Michigan right now, you're probably wishing the spring would arrive anytime soon. But the folks down in the southeastern United States are, across much of that region, are seeing spring coming as many as 3 weeks early this year.
And in Michigan, we know that some crops are at risk when we get earlier spring warm-ups that mm-hmm. are followed by hard freezes. Mm-hmm. What are some of the other implications of spring arriving earlier?
Well, I live here in Tucson, Arizona, and I got my first mosquito bite just this weekend. So there's been enough heat in the system to warm things up to let the mosquitoes start to get active. So ticks is another problem. That's a real issue. Again, both mosquitoes and ticks are disease vectors, and so not only do they cause discomfort, but they may also carry disease.
How do you make these maps?
So what we're doing is we are essentially taking what you would say is a weather service data set and applying a model to that. And the model is the relationship between when early leafing plants flower or leaf out, and relating that to the temperature records. So we have a daily time step. Basically, every day we run the model, and then we look at how it varies from the long-term average.
What do you want to do next with these maps?
These models that we have right now show a generalized index of spring and how it varies over space and time. And what we'd like to do is try to get into more specific models, what we call species-specific models, so we could do a better job making forecasts about some of the other important tree species, say, in your region, or, like we talked about earlier, ticks and mosquitoes. So wouldn't it be great if we had a forecast that would allow us to make plans about, oh, pollen season is just around the corner. I need to go get, you know, I need to go get my antihistamines. Or, okay, oh, I've got ticks out in the woods coming up next week, so when we go camping, we need to make sure that we take plenty of, you know, protective clothing. So species-specific models that can help people make decisions about how they're going to work and live and depend on their environment.
Jake Weltzien is an ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You can find the maps on our website, michiganradio.org. That's the Environment Report. I'm Rebecca Williams.
The White House is proposing to slash the EPA's overall budget by 25% to $6.1 billion and staffing by 20% to 12,400. The proposal would cut deeply into programs like climate protection and energy efficiency initiatives. State grants for lead cleanup, for example, would be cut 30% to 9 billion $5.8 million. Grants to help Native tribes combat pollution would be cut 30% to $45.8 million. An EPA climate protection program to reduce greenhouse gases would be slashed 70% down to $29 million. The proposal would cut funding for the Brownfields Cleanup Program by 42% to $14.7 million. It would also reduce funds for enforcing pollution laws by 11% to $153 million. Some of the cuts are unlikely to pass Congress, as they are popular with both Democrats and Republicans. Scott Pruitt, EPA's head, told U.S. mayors last week he would make a priority of cleanups of industrial and hazardous waste sites and improving water infrastructure. But the White House proposal guts those programs.
And in another major reversal on civil rights issues, the Department of Justice under Attorney General Jeff Sessions did an about-face on voter IDs this week. One day before an important hearing in the years-long Texas voter ID case, the Department of Justice withdrew its major claim in the matter. Courts have repeatedly ruled that those ID requirements that the GOP-controlled Texas legislature passed back in 2011 discriminate against minority, elderly, and poor voters. But the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals sent the case back to a lower court to take another look at whether lawmakers specifically intended to disenfranchise the groups when they enacted one of the most restrictive voter ID laws in the nation. Ezra Rosenberg, co-director of the Voting Rights Project of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, presented the case in court this week. Nell Abram with Free Speech Radio News spoke with him.
First, the merits of the case. What are the voter ID requirements in Texas, and how do they disenfranchise minority, elderly, and poor voters?
The only voter IDs that are acceptable are six: Texas driver's licenses, current or expired within 60 days, United States military ID, same restriction as to time, United States passport, United States naturalization papers with a photograph, and a license to carry firearms, and finally what's called an election identification card, which the legislature said was free in the sense that nothing has to be paid for the card, but in order to get the card, you have to present the same sort of IDs that the person otherwise doesn't have, otherwise he wouldn't have to ask for the election identification card. And of course, there are only the EICs and driver's licenses, which are the most prevalent form of ID that's possessed, can only be gotten at motor vehicle facilities. One-third of the counties in Texas do not have motor vehicle facilities. And of course, Texas being such a big state, it's very difficult for people, particularly those who do not have cars and do not have driver's licenses in the first place, to travel, perhaps take off from work and travel hours to get to motor vehicle facilities. The courts, and not just the United States District Court in the Southern District, but previously under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, the courts have consistently found that SB 14 discriminated against African-American and Latino voters in that they were 2 to 3 times less likely to possess these few forms of identification and 2 to 3 times more likely to be burdened in getting those IDs.
The U.S. Department of Justice was a partner in the case against the state of Texas until this week. On Inauguration Day, the DOJ asked for a delay, and then this week they joined forces with the state to request another delay, saying lawmakers are currently working on a fix. The court said no. Why was it important to move forward now?
Well, it's important to move forward now because if, as we say is the case, and as the United States District Court previously found is the case, this law was enacted with intentional discrimination, then it should not be on the books for one day more than is necessary. In addition, if in fact the court finds intentional discrimination, there are remedies that go into play, one of which is the immediate ordering that the law is no longer in effect. And second also is the discretion of the court to order that there is what's called 3C relief, and that 3C is under Section 3C of the Voting Rights Act, which would require Texas to present to the Department of Justice for further review any changes in either voting rights law, right laws generally or in voting ID laws. And in addition, there may be other relief that the court could order.
You mentioned the Voting Rights Act. In 2013, the Supreme Court struck down the enforcement piece of the landmark legislation from 1965. Now, Texas isn't the only state where courts are considering challenges to similarly discriminatory voting rules. How widespread are strict voter ID requirements, and what does the DOJ's reversal in Texas say about the government's willingness to ensure equal access to the polls across the country?
There are, I believe, dozens of states which now have various sorts of voting identification laws. Texas's is the most stringent in the country. The position that the states took this week, which was to ask the court for leave to allow it to withdraw its intent claim, is disturbing because the United States has been fighting this case for over 5 years, first under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, when before the Shelby case, and then under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And it has consistently and steadfastly and strongly taken the position that this law is not only discriminatory, but was enacted with a discriminatory intent. The facts have not changed. The law has not changed. The only thing that's changed is that there is now a different administration in place, and that should not change the position on this case, and it's very disturbing that it has.
Tuesday, the case was in the U.S. District Court in Corpus Christi, heard by Judge Nelva Gonzalez-Ramos. What took place during the hearing?
Well, initially, the attorney for the United States from the Department of Justice stood up and gave the argument that they'd given in their papers, which was the argument in support of their motion for leave to dismiss on the basis that there is legislation that's pending in the Texas legislature that might remedy some of the problems with SB 14, and argued that on that basis, the court should not rule on intent yet, and that is why the United States says it is withdrawing its intent claim. The judge has asked for further briefing on that issue, but most of the argument was devoted to our proofs that, in fact, this statute was enacted with discriminatory intent. And several lawyers for the plaintiffs, for the, what we call the private plaintiffs, the non-United States plaintiffs, argued vigorously that the facts are really not subject to refutation at this point, that because of the way the law was enacted, because of what legislature knew, because of what occurred as a result of SB 14 in terms of the disenfranchisement of disproportionately Black and Latino voters, because of the departures from the way you would act or expect the legislature to act in enacting this statute, because of the fact that this same legislature had passed two other laws that have been found by courts to be enacted with discriminatory intent. For a whole wealth of reasons, we argued that this law was enacted with discriminatory intent and should be vitiated immediately.
That was Ezra Rosenberg, co-director of the Voting Rights Project of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Rosenberg says a ruling in the case could be weeks or months away. Nell Abram, FSRN.
Sweden has decided to reintroduce a military draft for both men and women in the face of national security concerns and a growing threat from Russia. The nation is not a NATO member. It ended compulsory military service 7 years ago. Increased military activity in the Baltic region, along with Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014, prompted the ramp-up in military preparedness. Under the new plan, at least 4,000 18-year-olds could be called up to each year, starting in January 2018. The Swedish government is also planning an increase in military spending and is urging local governments to make contingency plans for war.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tom Flynn and Demi Hellenius. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to our friends at Free Speech Radio News and at KQED San Francisco. Our engineer Matthew Olson, KBOO Evening News Director, Zelos Marchant, and the Evening News Public Affairs Director is Kanan Schlesinger. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us at Facebook and on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Zelos Marchant. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Positively Revolting. Call in and voice your thoughts with Ani and Lynn. At 9, it's Pacific Underground. Interviews, documentaries, and political issues affecting Asians and Pacific Islanders in the Northwest. At 10, Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, a Radio Geekly debriefs on their experience at Wizard World Comic Con and forecasts the upcoming 2017 convention season. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can fix that by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donates. Good night.
Good night, Zelos.
Good night, Neverland.
Good night, Matthew.
Good night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
During World War II, the United States built nearly 13,000 B-17 Flying Fortress bombers. Today, only a dozen airworthy B-17 aircraft remain. One of them, the Madras Maiden, is currently in Portland to take part in the Liberty Foundation's 2017 Salute for Veterans Tour. The Madras Maiden was recently refurbished and is on its first public tour. On the very first stop on that tour is Portland, Oregon. This Saturday and Sunday, March 4th and 5th, this historic aircraft will be at Hillsborough Airport, available for ground tours and public flights. The B-17 is a four-engine heavy bomber that was chiefly used by the United States Army Air Forces in daylight strategic bombings of industrial and military targets in Germany. The planes were mostly based in England and Italy and would often fly for 8 hours per mission. Although they carried up to 10 50-caliber machine guns for defense against enemy fighter planes and were able to remain aloft after sustaining a lot of damage, thousands of planes and crewmen were lost. A B-17 was typically crewed by 10 men. Last Tuesday, KBOO reporters Brian Pritchett and Joe Leno went for a short flight aboard the plane and had the chance to talk to a few local veterans who took part in B-17 flight missions over Europe during World War II.
Phil Azure and Don Anderson were both B-17 tail gunners during the late stage of the war in Europe. Phil flew over 30 missions, Don only 22, his career in the bomber cut short by war's end. Though they served on different air crews, they each described similar experiences in training and in the air. Don was a native of Arlington, Washington, just a high school kid when the draft board drew his number.
I was born and raised 50 miles north of Seattle, a little town called Arlington.
Right.
So I was kind of a real rube, even more of a rube then. I didn't know anything. Well, I took my gunnery training in Yuma, Arizona, during the summer when it got up to 140 degrees on the line out there. It's pretty tough for a kid from Washington. But then they put the crews together in, I believe, Lincoln, Nebraska, and then we flew to Ardmore, Oklahoma, and that's where we trained together. And we spent months down there flying together as a crew.
After training, Don and the rest of his crew were carried by ship across the Atlantic to England, where they first met their B-17, which they named the Joker.
Then we eventually went to Boston, port of embarkation, and we got on the Queen Elizabeth. And there were 17,000 soldiers on there, a ship that was meant not to carry a tenth of that number of people. We were jammed on there. And we sailed over to Scotland and disembarked at the Firth of Clyde. And it took 2 or 3 days to get all the guys off of the ship, because not because it, they could get them off in a matter of hours, but they wouldn't know what to do with them. So they had to get them out and then decide, well, you're going here and you're going there and you're going someplace else. It took a long time.
The tail gunner, alone at the far end of the fuselage, was responsible for guarding the most valuable side of the aircraft. Phil Azure remembered with vivid amazement the first time he saw an enemy jet knife through his formation, and with sadness on other occasions as he watched planes full of comrades disintegrate and fall to earth. Don Anderson faced the reality of his situation with a touch of gallows humor.
Yeah.
Well, the tail gunner position was one that the German fighters wanted to kill the tail gunner first if they possibly could. Because then it was easier to shoot down the plane if they could kill the tail gunner. But I never told my mother that. She never knew about that. So. Well, I was just a high school kid, really, 19 years old, and just did what I was told. And I was sad that I didn't get to be a pilot like God had intended, but that's life. So I got to be philosophical about the whole thing.
When not flying, members of the crew would blow off stress in the flak shack, a converted English manor house.
I was in the flak shack, which was an old English manor, a beautiful, beautiful place, and they gave us excellent service. What they did was the strain of combat flying was so great that we needed a break near the end of our tour, so they sent us off for a week, and when the war ended. We all went to town, and whoopee, you know, gee, the fires were going, and people were hugging, and everybody was happy, the war is over. And I walked around, and I met this girl, and she was by herself, and I,